No, I will. She'll probably hate it anyway, he said. I mean, I think it's pretty solid, but she's operating with a whole different rule book.
That's true, Clemencia agreed.
Do you think there will even be a Hunger Games now?
He hadn't thought of that.
I don't know.
What with Arachne and then the funeral?
If they happen, they'll be delayed, I suppose.
I know you don't like them anyway.
Do you?
Does anyone really?
Clemencia asked.
Maybe they'll just send the tributes home.
The idea was not entirely unappealing when he thought of Lucy Gray. He wondered how the fallout from Arachne's death was affecting her. Were all the tributes being punished? Would they allow him to see her?
Yes, or make them Avoxes or something, said Clemencia.
It's awful, but not as bad as the arena. I mean, I'd rather be alive without a tongue than dead, wouldn't you?
I would, but I'm not sure my tribute would, said Coriolanus.
Can you still sing without a tongue?
I don't know.
Hum, maybe.
They had reached the gates of the citadel.
This place scared me when I was little.
It scares me still, said Coriolanus, which made her laugh. At the peacekeeper station, their retinas were scanned and checked against the capital files. Their book bags were taken and a guard escorted them down a long, gray corridor and onto an elevator that plunged down at least 25 floors. Coriolanus had never been so far underground and, surprisingly, found he liked it. Much as he loved the Snow's penthouse apartment, he'd felt so vulnerable when the bombs had fallen during the war. Here, it seemed, nothing could reach him. The elevator doors parted, and they stepped into a gigantic open laboratory. Rows of research tables, unfamiliar machines, and glass cases spread out into the distance. Coriolanus turned to the guard, but she closed the doors and left them without giving further instructions.
Shall we? He asked Clemencia.
They began to make their way cautiously into the lab.
I have a terrible feeling I'm going to break something, she whispered.
They walked along a wall of glass cases 15 feet high. Inside, a menagerie of creatures, some familiar, some altered to the point that no label could easily be attached, roamed and panted and flopped around in apparent unhappiness. Oversized fangs, claws, and flippers swiped the glass as they passed. A young man in a lab coat intercepted them and led them to a section of reptile cases. Here they found Dr. Gall peering into a large terrarium filled with hundreds of snakes. They were artificially bright, their skins almost glowing in shades of neon pink, yellow, and blue. No longer than a ruler and not much thicker than a pencil, they twisted into a psychedelic carpet that covered the bottom of the case.
Ah, here you are, Dr. Gall said with a grin. Say hello to my new babies.
Hello there, said Coriolanus, putting his face close to the glass to see the writhing mess. They reminded him of something, but he couldn't think what.
Is there a point to the color? Asked Clemencia.
There is a point to everything,
or nothing at all, depending on your worldview, said Dr. Gall.
Which brings me to your proposal. I liked it. Who wrote it? Just you two? Or did your brassy friend weigh in before her throat was cut?
Clemencia pressed her lips together, upset, but then Coriolanus saw her face tighten. She was not going to be intimidated.
The whole class discussed it as a group.
And Arachne was planning to help write it up last night, but then, as you said, he added.
But you two forged ahead, is that it?
Asked Dr. Gall.
That's right, said Clemencia. We wrote it up at the library, and I printed it out at my apartment last night. Then I gave it to Coriolanus so he could drop it off this morning, as assigned.
Dr. Gall addressed Coriolanus.
Is that how it happened?
Coriolanus felt put on the spot. I did drop it off this morning, yes. Well, just to the peacekeepers on guard. I wasn't allowed in, he said evasively. Something was strange about this line of questioning. Was that a problem?
I just wanted to make sure you'd both had your hands on it, said Dr. Gall.
I can show you the parts the group discussed and how they were developed in the proposal, he offered.
Yes, do that. Did you bring a copy?
She asked. Clemencia looked at Coriolanus expectantly. No, I didn't, he said. He wasn't thrilled with Clemencia laying it at his door when she'd been too shaky to even help write the thing, especially since she was one of the most formidable competitors for the Academy Prizes. Did you? They took our book bags. Clemencia turned to Dr. Gall. Perhaps we could use the copy we gave you?
Well, we could, but my assistant lined this very case with it while I was having my lunch, she said with a laugh.
Coriolanus stared down into the mass of wriggling snakes with their flicking tongues. Sure enough, he could catch phrases of his proposal between the coils.
Suppose you two retrieve it?
Dr. Gall suggested. It felt like a test. A weird Dr. Gall test, but still. And somehow planned, but he couldn't begin to guess to what end. He glanced at Clemencia and tried to remember if she was afraid of snakes, but he scarcely knew if he was himself. They didn't have snakes in the lab at school. She gave Dr. Gall a clenched smile.
Of course. Do we just reach in through the trap door on the top?
Dr. Gall removed the entire cover.
Oh, no, let's give you some room. Mr. Snow, why don't you start?
Coriolanus reached in slowly, feeling the warmth of the heated air.
That's right. Move gently. Don't disrupt them, Dr. Gall instructed.
He scooped his fingers under the edge of a sheet of his proposal and slowly slid it out from under the snakes. They slumped down into a heap, but didn't seem to mind much. I don't think they even noticed me, he said to Clemencia, who looked a little green. Here I go, then. She reached into the tank.
They can't see too well, and they hear even less, said Dr. Gall. But they know you're there. Snakes can smell you using their tongues. These mutts hear more than others.
Clemencia hooked a sheet with her fingernail and lifted it up. The snake stirred.
If you're familiar, if they have pleasant associations with your scent, a warm tank, for instance, they'll ignore you. A new scent, something foreign, that would be a threat, said Dr. Gall. You'd be on your own, little girl.
Coriolanus had just begun to put two and two together when he saw the look of alarm on Clemencia's face. She yanked her hand from the tank, but not before a half dozen neon snakes sank their fangs into her flesh. Chapter 8. Clemencia gave a blood-curdling scream, shaking her hand madly to rid it of the vipers. The tiny puncture wounds left by their fangs oozed the neon colors of their skins. Pus dyed bright pink, yellow, and blue dripped down her fingers. Lab assistants in white jackets materialized. Two pinned Clemencia to the floor while a third injected her with a scary-looking hypodermic needle filled with black fluid. Her lips turned purple and then bloodless before she passed out. The assistants dropped her onto a stretcher and whisked her away. Coriolanus began to follow them, but Dr. Gall stopped him with her voice.
Not you, Mr. Snow. You stay here.
But he stammered.
Will she die?
Anyone's guess, said Dr. Gall. She had dipped a hand back into the tank and was lightly trailing her gnarled fingers over her pets.
Clearly her scent was not on the paper. So, you wrote the proposal alone?
I did. There was no point in lying. Lying had probably killed Clemencia. Obviously, he was dealing with a lunatic who should be handled with extreme care.
Good. The truth, finally. I've no use for liars. What are lies but attempts to conceal some sort of weakness? If I see that side of you again, I'll cut you off. If Dean Highbottom punishes you for it, I won't stand in his way. Are we clear?
She wrapped one of the pink snakes around her wrist like a bracelet and seemed to be admiring it. Very clear, said Coriolanus.
It's good, your proposal, she said. Well thought out and simple to execute. I'm going to recommend my team review it and implement a version of the first stage.
All right, said Coriolanus, afraid to make more than the blandest of responses, surrounded as he was by lethal creatures that did her bidding. Dr. Gall laughed.
Oh, go home, or go see your friend if she's still there to see. It's time for my crackers and milk.
Coriolanus hurried off, bumping into a lizard tank and sending its inhabitants into a frenzy. He made a wrong turn, then another, and found himself in a ghoulish section of the lab where the glass cases housed humans with animal parts grafted to their bodies. Tiny feathered ruffs around their necks, talons, or even tentacles in place of fingers, and something, perhaps gills, embedded in their chests. His appearance startled them, and when a few opened their mouths to plead with him, he realized they were Avoxes. Their cries reverberated, and he caught a glimpse of small black birds perched above them. The name Jabberjay popped into his mind, a brief chapter in his genetics class. The failed experiment, the bird that could repeat human speech, that had been a tool for espionage until the rebels had figured out its abilities and sent it back carrying false information. Now the useless creatures were creating an echo chamber filled with the Avox's pitiful wails. Finally, a woman in a lab coat and oversized pink bifocals intercepted him, scolded him for disturbing the birds, and escorted him back to the elevator. As he waited, a security camera blinked down at him, and he compulsively tried to smooth out the lone, crumpled page of his proposal he'd crushed in his hand. Peacekeepers met him above, returned both his and Clemencia's book bags, and marched him out of the citadel. Coriolanus made it down the street and around the corner before his legs gave way, and he dropped onto the curb. The sun hurt his eyes, and he couldn't seem to catch his breath. He was exhausted, having not slept the night before, but hyper with adrenaline. What had just happened? Was Clemencia dead? He had not begun to come to terms with Arachne's violent end, and now this? It was like the Hunger Games, only they weren't district kids. The capital was supposed to protect them. He thought of Sejanus telling Dr. Gall it was the government's job to protect everybody, even the people in the districts, but he still wasn't sure how to square that with the fact that they'd been such recent enemies. But certainly the Child of a Snow should be a top priority. He could be dead if Clemencia had written the proposal instead of him. He buried his head in his hands, confused, angry, and most of all, afraid. Afraid of Dr. Gall. Afraid of the capital. Afraid of everything. If the people who were supposed to protect you played so fast and loose with your life, then how did you survive? Not by trusting them, that was for sure. And if you couldn't trust them, who could you trust? All bets were off. Coriolanus nodded up at the memory of the snake fang sinking into flesh. Poor Clemmy. Could she really be dead? And in that nightmarish way? If she was it his fault? For not calling her out for lying? It seemed such a minor infraction, but would Dr. Gall place blame on him for covering for her? If she died, he could be in all kinds of trouble. He guessed that in an emergency, a person would be taken to the nearby Capitol Hospital, so he found himself running in its direction. Once inside the cool entrance hall, he followed the signs to the emergency room. As soon as the automated door slid open, he could hear Clemencia screaming, just as she had when the snakes bit her. At least she was still alive. He babbled something to the nurse at the counter, and she made enough sense of it to have him take a seat just as a wave of dizziness hit him. He must have looked terrible because she brought him two packets of nutritional crackers and a glass of sweet, fizzy lemon drink, which he tried to sip and ended up gulping down, longing for a refill. The sugar made him feel a bit better, although not enough to try the crackers, which he pocketed. By the time the attending doctor emerged from the back, he was almost in control of himself. The doctor reassured him. They'd treated the victims of mishaps at the lab before. Since the antidote had been swiftly administered, there was every reason to believe Clemencia would survive, although there might be some neurological damage. She'd be hospitalized until they were sure she was stable. If he checked back in a few days, she might be ready for visitors. Coriolanus thanked the doctor, handed over her book bag, and agreed when he suggested that the best thing would be to return home. As he retraced his steps to the entrance, he spotted Clemencia's parents rushing in his direction and managed to conceal himself in a doorway. He didn't know what the Dovecotes had been told, but he had no interest in talking to them, especially before he'd worked out his story. The lack of a plausible story, preferably one that absolved him of being an accessory to her condition, made his return to school or even home impossible. Tigris would not be home until supper at the earliest, and the Grand Mam would be horrified by his situation. Strangely, he found the only person he wanted to talk to was Lucy Gray, who was both clever and unlikely to repeat his words. His feet carried him to the zoo before he had really considered the difficulties he would encounter there. A pair of impressively armed peacekeepers were on guard at the main entrance, with several more milling around behind them. At first they waved him away. Instructions were to allow no visitors to the zoo. But Coriolanus played the mentor card, and at this point some of them recognized him as the boy who'd tried to save Arachne. His celebrity was enough to convince them to call in a request for an exception. The peacekeeper spoke to Dr. Gall directly, and Coriolanus could hear her distinctive cackle shooting out of the phone, even though he stood several yards away. He was allowed in with a peacekeeper, but only for a short time. Trash from the fleeing crowd was still strewn along the path to the monkey house. Dozens of rats darted about, gnawing on leftovers from bits of rotting food to shoes lost in the panic. Although the sun was high, several raccoons foraged, scooping up tidbits in their clever little hands. One chewed on a dead rat, warning the others to give it a wide berth.
"Not the zoo I remember," said the peacekeeper. "Nothing but kids in cages and vermin running loose."
At points along the path, Coriolanus could see small containers of white powder tucked under boulders or against walls. He remembered the poison used by the capital during the siege, a time with little food but plenty of rats. Humans, particularly dead ones, had become their daily fare. During the worst of it, of course, humans had eaten humans as well. There was no point in feeling superior to the rats.
"Is that rat poison?" he asked the peacekeeper.
"Yeah, some new stuff they're trying out today. But the rats are so smart they won't go near it." He shrugged. "It's what they gave us to work with."
Inside the cage, the tributes, shackled again, pressed against the back wall or positioned themselves behind the rock formations, as if trying to make themselves as inconspicuous as possible.
"You have to keep your distance," said the peacekeeper. "Your girl isn't likely a threat, but who knows? Another might attack you. You have to stay back where they can't touch you."
Coriolanus nodded and went to his usual rock, but remained standing behind it. He didn't feel threatened by the tributes. They were the least of his problems. But he didn't want to give Dean Highbottom any other excuse to punish him. At first, he couldn't locate Lucy Gray. Then he made eye contact with Jessup, who sat propped against the back wall, holding what appeared to be the snow's handkerchief to his neck. Jessup gave something beside him a shake, and Lucy Gray sat straight up with a start. For a moment, she seemed disoriented. When she spotted Coriolanus, she wiped the sleep from her eyes and combed her loose hair back with her fingers. She lost her balance as she rose and reached out to catch herself on Jessup's arm. Still unsteady, she began to make her way across the cage to him, dragging the chains with her. Was it the heat? The trauma of the killing? Hunger? Since the capital wasn't feeding the tributes, she'd had nothing since Arachne's murder, when she'd vomited up the precious food from the crowd, and probably his bread pudding and the apple from the morning as well. So she'd gone almost 5 days on a meatloaf sandwich and a plum. He was going to have to find a way to get her more to eat, even if it was cabbage soup. When she'd crossed the waterless moat, he held up a cautionary hand. "I'm sorry, we can't get close." Lucy Gray stopped a few feet from the bars.
Surprised you got in at all.
Her throat, her skin, her hair, everything seemed parched in the hot afternoon sun. A bad bruise on her arm had not been there the previous night. Who had hit her? Another tribute or a guard?
I didn't mean to wake you, he said.
She shrugged.
It's nothing. Jessup and I take turns sleeping. Capital rats have a taste for people.
The rats are trying to eat you? Coriolanus asked, revolted at the thought.
Well, something bit Jessup's neck the first night we were here. Too dark to see what, but he mentioned fur. And last night, something crawled over my leg.
She indicated a container of white powder by the bars.
That stuff doesn't do a lick of good.
Coriolanus had a terrible image of her lying dead under a swarm of rats. It wiped away the last few shreds of resistance he had, and despair engulfed him. For her, for himself, for the both of them.
Oh, Lucy Gray, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry about all of this. It's not your fault, she said.
You must hate me. You should. I would hate me, he said.
I don't hate you. The Hunger Games weren't your idea, she replied.
But I'm participating in them. I'm helping them happen. His head dropped in shame. I should be like Sejanus and at least try to quit.
No, don't. Please don't. Don't leave me to go through this alone.
She took a step toward him and almost fainted. Her hands caught the bars and she slid down to the ground. Ignoring the guard's warning, he impulsively stepped over the rock and crouched down across the bars from her.
Are you all right?
She nodded, but she didn't look all right. He'd wanted to tell her about the scare with the snakes and Clemencia's brush with death. He'd hoped to ask her advice, but it all paled in comparison to her situation. He remembered the crackers the nurse had given him and fumbled for the crumpled packets in his pocket.
I brought you these. They're not big, but they're very nutritious.
That sounded stupid. How could their nutritional value matter to her? He realized he was just parroting what his teachers had said during the war, when one of the incentives for going to school had been the free snack provided by the government. The scratchy, tasteless things washed down with water were all some of the kids had to eat for the day. He remembered their little claw-like hands tearing into the wrapping, and the desperate crunching that followed. Lucy Gray immediately ripped open a packet and stuffed one of the two crackers into her mouth, chewing and swallowing the dry thing with difficulty. She pressed a hand against her stomach, sighed, and ate the second more slowly. The food seemed to focus her, and her voice sounded calmer.
Thanks, she said. That's better.
Eat the others, he urged, nodding to the second packet. She shook her head.
No, I'll save these for Jessup. He's my ally now.
Your ally? Coriolanus was perplexed. How could one have an ally in the games?
Uh-huh. The tributes from District 12 are going down together, said Lucy Gray. He's not the brightest star in the Dipper, but he's strong as an ox.
Two crackers seemed a small price to pay for Jessup's protection. I'll get you more to eat as soon as I can, and it looks like people are going to be allowed to send food into the arena. It's official now.
That'd be good. More food would be good.
She leaned her head forward and rested it on the bars.
Then, like you said, it might make sense to sing. Make people want to help me.
At the interview, he suggested, you could sing the Valley Song again.
Maybe.
Her brow furrowed in thought.
They showing this in all Pan Am or just the capital?
All Pan Am, I think, he answered. But you won't get anything from the districts.
Not expecting to. Not the point, she said. Maybe I will sing, though. Be better with a guitar or something.
I can try to find you one. Not that the Snows had any instruments, except for the grandmam's daily anthem and his mother's long-ago bedtime songs, there'd been little music in his life until Lucy Gray appeared. He rarely listened to the Capitol radio broadcast, which mostly played marches and propaganda songs. Those all sounded the same to him.
Hey! The peacekeeper waved at him from the path. That's too close! Time's up, anyway.
Coriolanus rose. I better go if I want them to let me in again.
Sure. Sure, and thanks. For the crackers and all,
said Lucy Gray, grasping the bars to struggle to her feet.
He reached through the bars to help her up. It's nothing.
Not to you, maybe, she said. But it's meant the world having someone show up like I mattered.
You do matter, he said.
Well, there's a lot of evidence to the contrary.
She rattled her chains and gave them a tug. And then, as if remembering something, she looked up at the sky.
You matter to me, he insisted.
The capital may not value her, but he did.
Hadn't he just poured his heart out to her?
Time to go, Mr. Snow, the peacekeeper called.
You matter to me, Lucy Gray, he repeated.
His words drew her eyes back to him, but she still seemed distant.
Look, kid, don't make me report you, said the peacekeeper.
I've got to go. Coriolanus started to leave.
Hey,
she said with a certain urgency. He turned back.
Hey, I want you to know I don't really believe you're here for grades or glory. You're a rare bird, Coriolanus.
You too, he said.
She dipped her head in agreement and headed back to Jessup, her chains leaving a trail in the dirty straw and rat droppings. When she reached her partner, she lay down and curled up in a ball, as if exhausted by the brief encounter. Twice he tripped on his way out of the zoo, and he recognized that he was too tired to come up with any good solutions to anything. It was late enough now that his arrival at home wouldn't seem suspicious, so he headed back to the apartment. He had the misfortune to bump into his classmate, Persephone Price, the daughter of the infamous Nero Price, who'd once cannibalized the maid. They ended up walking together, since they were neighbors. She'd been assigned to mentor Mizzen, a sturdy 13-year-old boy from District 4, and so had been present when he and Clemencia had been called from class. He dreaded any discussion of the proposal, but she was still too distraught over Arachne's death to talk about anything else. Usually, he avoided Persephone altogether, because he could never help wondering if she had known the ingredients of her wartime stew. For some time, he'd felt afraid of her, but now she only inspired disgust, no matter how many times he reminded himself of her innocence. With her dimples and hazel-green eyes, she was prettier than any girl in his year, with the possible exception of Clemencia. Well, pre-snakebite Clemencia. But the idea of kissing her repulsed him. Even now, as she gave him a tearful hug goodbye, all he could think of was that severed leg. Coriolanus dragged himself up the stairs, his thoughts darker than ever at the memory of the poor maid collapsed from hunger in the street. How long could he expect Lucy Gray to last? She was fading fast, weak and distracted, injured and broken, but most of all, slowly starving to death. By tomorrow, she might not be able to stand. If he didn't find a way to feed her, she'd be dead before the Hunger Games even began. Chapter 9. When he reached the apartment, the grandmam took one look at him and suggested a nap before supper. He fell on his bed, feeling too stressed to ever sleep again. The next thing he knew, Tigress was gently shaking his shoulder. A tray on his night table gave off the comforting smell of noodle soup. Sometimes the butcher would give her chicken carcasses for free, and she'd boil them into something wonderful.
Corio, she said. Satyria has called 3 times, and I can't think of any more excuses. Come on, eat some supper and call her back.
Did she ask about Clemencia? Does everyone know? He blurted out.
Clemencia Dovecoat? No, why would she?
Tigress asked.
It was so awful. He told her the story in all its gory detail. As he spoke, the color left her face.
Dr. Gall,
made the snakes bite her? Over a little white lie like that?
She did. And she didn't care at all whether Clemmy survived, he said. Just shooed me out so she could get her afternoon snack.
That's sadistic. Or completely demented, said Tigress. Should you report her?
To who? She's the head game maker, he said. She works directly with the president. She'll say it was our fault for lying. Tigress thought it over.
All right, don't report her. Or confront her. Just avoid her as much as possible.
That's hard as a mentor. She keeps showing up at the academy to play with this rabbit mutt and ask a lot of crazy questions. One word from her could make or break my prize. He rubbed his face with his hands. And Arachne's dead, and Clemencia's all full of venom, and Lucy Gray... Well, that's another really awful story. I doubt she'll make it to the games, and maybe that's for the best. Tigress tucked a spoon into his hand.
Eat your soup.
We've gotten through worse than this.
Snow lands on top?
Snow lands on top, he said with so little conviction they had to laugh. It made him feel a bit more normal. He took a few bites of soup to please her, then realized he was starving and made short work of it. When Citeria called again, he almost launched into his confession. But it turned out that all she wanted to do was ask him to sing the anthem at Arachne's funeral in the morning.
Your heroics at the zoo, combined with the fact that you're the only one who knows all the words, made you the faculty's first choice.
I'd be honored, of course, he replied.
Good.
Citeria slurped something, causing the ice to clink in her glass, then came up for air.
How are things with your tribute?
Coriolanus hesitated. To complain might seem childish, like he couldn't handle his own problems. He almost never asked Citeria for help. But then he thought of Lucy Gray buckling under the weight of her chains and threw caution to the wind. Not well. I saw Lucy Gray today, just for a minute. She's very weak. The capital hasn't fed her at all.
Since she left District 12? Why, that's been, what, 4 days?
Citeria asked, surprised.
5.
I don't think she's going to make it to the Hunger Games. I'm not even going to have a tribute to Mentor, he said. A lot of us won't.
Well, that's not fair. It's like telling you to do an experiment with broken equipment, she responded. And now the games will be delayed at least another day or two.
She paused, then added,
Let me see what I can do.
He hung up and turned to Tigress. They want me to sing at the funeral. She didn't mention Clemencia. They must be keeping it a secret.
Then that's what you do, too, said Tigress. Maybe they'll pretend the whole thing didn't happen.
Maybe they won't even tell Dean Highbottom, he said, brightening. Then another thought hit him.
Tigress?
I just remembered.
I can't really sing.
And somehow, this was the funniest thing either of them had ever heard. The grandmam, however, thought it was no laughing matter, and the following morning she had him up at dawn so she could coach him. At the end of every line she'd poke him in his ribs with a ruler and shout,
Breathe!
Until he couldn't imagine making any other choice. For the third time that week she sacrificed one of her darlings to his future, pinning a light blue rosebud to his carefully pressed uniform jacket and saying,
There! It matches your eyes.
Looking sharp, with a belly full of oatmeal and a rib cage dotted with bruises reminding him to inhale, he set off for the academy. Although it was Saturday, the entire student body reported to homeroom before they assembled on the front steps of the academy, divided neatly and alphabetically by class. By virtue of his assignment, Coriolanus found himself in the front row with faculty and distinguished guests. First and foremost, President Ravenstill. Citeria gave him a quick overview of the program, but the only thing that stuck in his head was that his rendition of the anthem opened the ceremonies. He didn't mind public speaking, but had never sung publicly. There was little occasion to in Pan Am. It was one reason that Lucy Gray's song had caught people's attention. He calmed his nerves by reminding himself that even if he howled like a dog, there wasn't much to compare him to. Across the avenue, the temporary stand set up for the funeral procession quickly filled with mourners dressed in black, the one color everyone could be counted on to have, given the loss of loved ones during the war. He looked for the cranes, but couldn't spot them in the crowd. The academy and the surrounding buildings were festooned with funeral banners and sported Capitol flags in every window. Numerous cameras were positioned to record the event, and multiple Capitol TV reporters streamed live commentary. Coriolanus thought it was quite a display for Arachne, disproportionate to both her life and death, the latter of which could have been avoided if she'd refrained from being such an exhibitionist. So many people had died heroically in the war with so little recognition that it grated on him. He was relieved that he was singing instead of having to praise her talents, which, if memory served, were limited to being loud enough to fill the school auditorium without a mic and the ability to balance a spoon on her nose. And Dean Highbottom had accused him of showboating? Still, he reminded himself, she was practically family. The academy clock struck 9, and the crowd fell silent. On cue, Coriolanus rose and walked to the podium. Citeria had promised accompaniment, but the silence stretched so long he actually drew breath to begin the anthem before a tinny version began to play over the sound system, giving him 16 measures of introduction. Gem of Panem, mighty city, through the ages you shine anew. His singing was more like sustained talking than a melodic tour de force, but the song was not particularly challenging. The high note the Grand Mam consistently missed was optional. Most people sang it an octave lower. With the memory of her ruler prodding him, he sailed through it, never missing a note or running out of breath. He sat to generous applause and an approving nod from the president, who now took the podium.
2 days ago, Arachne Crane's young and precious life was ended, and so we mourn another victim of the criminal rebellion that yet besieges us, the president intoned. Her death was as valiant as any on the battlefield, her loss more profound as we claim to be at peace. But no peace will exist while this disease eats away at all that is good and noble in our country. Today we honor her sacrifice with a reminder that while evil exists, it does not prevail. And once again we bear witness as our great capital brings justice to Pan Am.
The drums began a slow, deep boom, and the crowd turned as the funeral procession rounded a corner onto the street. Although not as wide as the Corso, Scholars Road easily held the honor guard of peacekeepers, standing shoulder to shoulder, 20 wide and 40 deep, that stepped in flawless uniformity to the rhythm of the drums. Coriolanus had wondered about the strategy of telling the districts about a tribute killing a capital girl. But now he saw the point. Behind the peacekeepers came a long flatbed truck with a crane affixed to it. High in the air, the bullet-ridden body of the District 10 girl, Brandy, dangled from its hook. Shackled to the truck bed, looking utterly filthy and defeated, were the remaining 23 tributes. The length of their restraints made it impossible to stand, so they either crouched or sat on the bare metal floor. This was just another chance to remind the districts that they were inferior and that there would be repercussions for their resistance. He could see Lucy Gray trying to hold on to a shred of dignity, sitting as upright as the chains would allow and gazing straight ahead, ignoring the corpse swinging gently over her head. But it was no use. The dirt, the shackles, the public display, it was too much to overcome. He tried to imagine conducting himself under those circumstances until he realized this was undoubtedly what Sejanus was doing and snapped out of it. Another battalion of peacekeepers followed the tributes, paving the way for a quartet of horses.
They were decked in garlands and pulled an ornate wagon with a pure white coffin draped in flowers. Behind the coffin came the Cranes, riding in a horse-drawn chariot. At least her family had the decency to look uncomfortable. The procession halted when the coffin drew up in front of the podium. Dr. Gall, who'd been sitting next to the president, approached the mic. Coriolanus thought it was a mistake to let her speak at such a moment, but she must have left the crazy lady and her pink snake bracelets at home, because she spoke with a stern and intelligent clarity.
Arachne Crane, we, your fellow citizens of Panem, vow that your death will not be in vain. When one of ours is hit, we hit back twice as hard. The Hunger Games will go forward with more energy and commitment than ever before, as we add your name to the long list of the innocent who died defending a righteous and just land. Your friends, family, and fellow citizens salute you and dedicate the 10th Hunger Games to your memory.
So now that loudmouth Arachne was a defender of a righteous and just land. Yes, she laid down her life, taunting her tribute with a sandwich, thought Coriolanus. Maybe her gravestone could read, "Casualty of Cheap Laughs." A row of peacekeepers in red sashes lifted their guns and sent several volleys over the procession, which then rolled down a few blocks and disappeared around a corner. As the crowd thinned, several people took the pained look on Coriolanus' face as sorrow at Arachne's death, when ironically, he felt like killing her all over again. Still, he felt he'd handled himself well, until he turned to find Dean Highbottom looking down at him.
"My condolences on the loss of your friend," the dean said, "and on your student.
It's a difficult day for all of us, but the procession was very moving," Coriolanus replied.
"Did you think so? I found it excessive and in poor taste," said Dean Highbottom.
Taken by surprise, Coriolanus let out a short laugh before he recovered and tried to look shocked. The dean dropped his gaze to Coriolanus's blue rosebud.
"It's amazing how little things change. After all the killing, after all the agonized promises to remember the cost, after all of that, I can't distinguish the bud from the blossom."
He gave the rose a tap with his forefinger, adjusting the angle, and smiled.
"Don't be late to lunch. I hear we're having pie."
The only good thing about the encounter was that it turned out there really was pie. Peach, this time, at the special buffet in the school dining hall. Unlike on the day of the reaping, Coriolanus loaded his plate with fried chicken and took the largest wedge of pie he could find. He slathered his biscuits with butter and had 3 refills of grape punch, filling the last glass so much it spilled over, and he stained his linen napkin, sopping it up. Let people talk. The chief mourner needed sustenance, but even as he ate, he recognized it as a sign that his usual gift for self-control was eroding. He blamed it on Dean Highbottom and his continual harassment. What was he babbling on about today, anyway? Buds? Blossoms? He should be locked up somewhere, or even better, deported to a far-off outpost to leave decent capital people in peace. Just the thought of him sent Coriolanus back for more pie. Sejanus, however, poked at his chicken and biscuits without taking even one bite. If Coriolanus had disliked the funeral parade, it had to have been misery for Sejanus. "They'll report you if you throw out all that food," Coriolanus reminded him. He wasn't crazy about the guy, but he didn't particularly want to see him punished.
"Right," said Sejanus,
but he still seemed unable to down more than a sip of punch. As the luncheon was finishing up, Citeria gathered the 22 active mentors to inform them that not only were the Hunger Games still on, they were supposed to be the most visible yet. With this in mind, they were to escort their tributes on a tour of the arena that very afternoon. It was to be aired live to the entire country, somehow driving home the resolution Dr. Gall had made at the funeral.
The head game maker felt that separating the capital kids from the district ones suggested weakness, as if they were too afraid of their enemies to be in their presence. The tributes would be handcuffed, but not fully shackled. The peacekeepers' top sharpshooters would be among their guards, but the mentors were to be seen side by side with their charges. Coriolanus could sense some reluctance among his classmates. Several of their parents had lodged complaints about shoddy security after Arachne's death, but no one spoke up, none of them wanting to seem cowardly. The whole thing seemed dangerous and ill-advised to him. What would prevent other tributes from turning on their mentors? But he'd never say so. A part of him wondered if Dr. Gall wasn't hoping for another act of violence so she could punish another tribute, maybe a live one this time in front of the cameras. This further display of Dr. Gall's callousness made him feel mutinous. He glanced over at Sejanus's plate. All done?
I can't eat today, said Sejanus. I don't know what to do with this.
Their section had emptied. Under the table, Coriolanus spread his stained linen napkin on his lap. He felt even more delinquent when he realized it was emblazoned with the capital seal.
Put it here, he said with a furtive glance.
Sejanus gave a look around and quickly transported the chicken and biscuits to the napkin. Coriolanus gathered it up and stuffed the whole thing in his book bag. They were not allowed to take food from the dining hall, and certainly not for a tribute, but where else would he get some before the tour? Lucy Gray couldn't eat the stuff in front of the cameras, but her dress had deep pockets. He resented that half of his takings would go to Jessup now, but maybe that investment would pay off when the games began.
Thanks. You're quite the rebel,
said Sejanus, as they carried their trays to the conveyor belt that ran to the kitchen.
I'm bad news, all right, said Coriolanus.
The mentors piled into a few academy vans and headed for the Capitol Arena, which had been built across the river to prevent crowds from swamping the downtown. In its day, the huge state-of-the-art amphitheater had been the site of many an exciting sporting, entertainment, or military event. High-profile executions of the enemy were staged there during the war, making it a target for the rebel bombers. While the original structure stood, it was battered and unstable now, useful only as a venue for the Hunger Games. The lush field of meticulously tended grass had died from neglect. It was riddled with bomb craters, with weeds providing the only greenery on the expanse of dirt. Rubble from the explosions, chunks of metal and stone, lay everywhere, and the 15-foot wall that encircled the field was fissured and pockmarked from the shrapnel. Each year, the tributes would be locked in with nothing but an arsenal of knives, swords, maces, and the like to facilitate the bloodshed while the audience watched from home. At the end of the games, the one who had managed to survive would be shipped back to their district, the bodies removed, the weapons collected, and the doors locked until the following year. No maintenance, no cleanup. Wind and rain might wash away the bloodstains, but capital hands would not. Professor Sickle, their chaperone for the outing, ordered the mentors to leave their belongings in the vans when they arrived. Coriolanus stuffed the food-filled napkin in one of his front pants pockets and kept it covered with the hem of his jacket. As they stepped from the air conditioning into the blazing sun, he saw the tribute standing in a line in handcuffs, heavily guarded by peacekeepers. The mentors were directed to take their places beside their respective tributes, who'd been lined up numerically, so he was near the end with Lucy Gray. Only Jessup and his mentor, Lysistrata, who couldn't tip the scales at 100 pounds, were behind him. In front of him, Clemencia's tribute, Reaper, the one who'd strangled him in the truck, stood glowering at the ground. If it came to a mentor-tribute showdown, the odds were not in Coriolanus's favor. Despite her delicate appearance, Lysistrata had some grit. The daughter of the physicians who treated President Ravenstill, she'd been lucky to get a mentorship, and she'd apparently been working hard to connect with Jessup.
I brought you some cream for your neck, Coriolanus heard her whisper, but you must keep it hidden.
Jessup made a grunt of assent.
I'll put it in your pocket when I can.
The peacekeepers removed the heavy bars from the entrance. The massive doors swung open, revealing a huge lobby lined with boarded-up booths and fly-specked posters advertising events from before the war. Holding their formation, the kids followed the soldiers deep within to the far side of the lobby. A bank of full-height turnstiles, each with three curved metal arms, stood covered in a thick layer of dust. They required a capital token for admittance, the same one still used for the price of a trolley fare. This entrance was for the poor people, Coriolanus thought. Or perhaps not poor. The word plebeian came to mind. The Snow family had entered the arena at another entrance, demarcated by a velvet rope. Certainly, their box could not be accessed with a trolley token. Unlike much of the arena, it had a roof, a retractable glass window, and air conditioning that had made the hottest day comfortable. An AVOX had been assigned to them, bringing food and drink and toys for him and Tigris. If he grew bored, he'd nap on the plush, cushioned seats. Peacekeepers posted at two turnstiles pumped tokens into the slots, so each tribute and mentor could pass through simultaneously. At each rotation, a cheerful voice piped, "Enjoy the show!"
"Can't you override the ticket barrier?" asked Professor Sickle.
"We could if we had the key, but no one seems to know where it is," said a peacekeeper.
"Enjoy the show," the turnstile told Coriolanus as he passed through. He gave the arm at his waist a backward push and realized that no exit was possible. His eyes traveled to the tops of the turnstiles, where iron bars filled the space to the arched doorway. He guessed the patrons of the cheap seats left the building through passages elsewhere. While that was probably seen as a plus for crowd dispersal, it did nothing to calm a jittery mentor on a questionable field trip. On the far side of the turnstiles, a squad of peacekeepers marched into a passageway, guided only by the red glow of emergency lights on the floor. On either side, smaller arches leading to different seating levels were marked. The line of tributes and mentors fell into step, flanked by tight columns of peacekeepers. As they moved into the gloom, Coriolanus took a page from Lysistrata's book and used the opportunity to slip the napkin of food into Lucy Gray's cuffed hands. It swiftly disappeared into a ruffled pocket. There, she was not going to starve to death on his watch. Her hand found his, intertwining their fingers and sending a buzz through his body at their closeness, at this small intimacy in the dark. He gave her hand a final squeeze and released it as they headed into the sunlight at the end of the passageway, where such a display would have been inexplicable. He'd been to the arena several times as a small boy, to see the circus mostly, but also to cheer military displays under his father's command. For the past 9 years, he'd watched at least part of the games on television. But nothing prepared him for the sensation of walking out through the main gate, beneath the enormous scoreboard and onto the field. Some of the mentors and tributes gasped at the sheer size of the place and the grandeur that defied even the decay. Staring up at the towering rows of seats made him feel diminished to the point of insignificance. A raindrop in a flood. A pebble in an avalanche. The sight of the camera crews brought him back to himself, and he adjusted his face to say that nothing much really impressed a Snow. Lucy Gray, who seemed more alert and moved better without the weight of the chains, gave a wave to Lepidus Malmsey, but like all the reporters, he remained stony-faced and didn't engage. Their directive had been clear. Gravity and retribution were the hallmarks of the day. Soteria's use of the term tour had suggested a sightseeing excursion, and while he had not anticipated pleasure, he had not expected the palpable sadness of the place either. The peacekeepers who had been flanking them spread out as the kids dutifully followed the lead squad around the inside perimeter of the oval, forming a dusty, joyless parade. Coriolanus remembered the circus performers taking the same route, riding elephants and horses, bespangled and brimming with mirth. With the exception of Sejanus, probably all of his classmates would have been in the audience too. Ironically, Arachne would have been in the box adjacent to his, dressed in a sequined costume,
and cheering at the top of her lungs.
Coriolanus surveyed the arena, looking for anything that might be an advantage for Lucy Gray.
The high wall that enclosed the field, keeping the audience above the action, had some promise. The damaged surface provided hand and footholds, offering access to the seats for a nimble climber. Several of the gates spaced symmetrically around the wall looked compromised as well, but as he was unsure what lay beyond in the tunnels, he thought those should be approached with caution. Too easy to get trapped. The stands would definitely be her best bet, if she could climb up. He made mental notes for later. As the line began to stretch out, he initiated a whispered conversation with Lucy Gray.
It was awful this morning, seeing you like that. Well, at least they fed us first, she said.
Really? Had his conversation with Soteria triggered that?
A couple of kids blacked out when they tried to round us up last night. I think they decided that if they want to have anyone left for their show, they're going to have to feed us. Mostly bread and cheese. We got dinner and breakfast, too. But don't worry, I've got plenty of room left for whatever's in my pocket.
She sounded more like her old self.
Was that you I heard singing? Oh, yes,
he admitted.
They asked me to sing because they thought Arachne and I were such great friends. We weren't, and I'm embarrassed you heard me. I like your voice. My daddy would have said it had real authority. Just didn't care much for the song,
Lucy Gray replied.
Thanks. That means a lot coming from you, he said.
She nudged him with her elbow.
I wouldn't broadcast that. Most people here think I'm lower than a snake's belly.
Coriolanus shook his head and grinned.
What?
She said.
You just have funny expressions.
Not funny, per se, more colorful, he told her.
Well, I don't say per se much, if that's what you mean,
she quipped.
No, I like it. It makes the way I talk seem so stiff. What was it you called me that day in the zoo? Something about cake,
he remembered.
Oh, the cake with the cream? You don't say that?
She asked.
Well, it's a compliment. Where I come from, cake can be pretty dry. And cream's as scarce as hen's teeth.
For a moment, he laughed, forgetting where they were, how depressing the backdrop. For a moment, there was just her smile, the musical cadence of her voice, and the hint of flirtation. Then the world exploded. Chapter 10. Coriolanus knew bombs, and they terrified him. Even as the impact threw him off his feet and tossed him farther into the arena, his arms lifted to cover his head. When he hit the ground, he automatically flattened onto his belly, cheek pressed into the dust, one arm bent up to guard his exposed eye and ear. The first explosion, which seemed to come from the main gate, initiated a chain of eruptions around the arena. Running was out of the question. It was all he could do to cling to the rumbling ground, hope for it to stop, and try to keep his panic in check. He entered what he and Tigris had nicknamed bomb time. That surreal period when a moment stretched and contracted in ways that seemed to defy science. During the war, the capital had assigned every citizen a shelter near their residence. The Snow's magnificent building had a basement level so sturdy and spacious, it accommodated not only its residents, but half the block. Unfortunately, the capital's surveillance system depended heavily on electricity. With the power sketchy and the grid flickering on and off like a firefly due to rebel interference in District 5, the sirens were unreliable, and they were often caught unawares with no time to retreat to the basement. At these times, he and Tigris and the Grandmam, unless she was singing the anthem, would hide under the dining table, an impressive thing carved from a single block of marble, which sat in an interior room. Even with the absence of windows and the solid rock over his head, Coriolanus's muscles always went rigid with terror when he heard the whistling of the bombs, and it would be hours before he felt he could walk right. The streets weren't safe either, nor the academy. You could be bombed anywhere.
but usually he had a better place to shelter than this. Now, naked to the attack, lying in the open air, he waited for the interminable bomb time to end, and wondered how much damage his internal organs were incurring. No hovercraft. The realization bubbled up in his brain. There had been no hovercraft. These bombs had been planted, then? He could smell smoke, so some of them were probably incendiary. He pressed his daily handkerchief over his mouth and nose. Squinting through the black haze thickened with dirt from the arena, he could see Lucy Gray about 15 feet away, curled up in a ball, forehead on the ground and fingertips lodged in her ears, which was the best she could do with the cuffs on. She coughed helplessly. "Cover your face! Use the napkin!" he called out. She didn't look over, but must have heard, because she rolled to her side and retrieved it from her pocket. The biscuits and chicken fell to the ground as she pressed the cloth to her face. She had a vague thought that this would not be conducive to her singing. A lull fooled him into thinking the episode had ended, but just as he lifted his head, a final explosion in the stands above him demolished what had once been a snack stand, that pink-spun sugar, those caramel-coated apples, and burning debris rained down on him. Something struck his head hard, and the heavy weight of a beam landed diagonally across his back, pinning him to the ground. Stunned, Coriolanus lay almost senseless for a bit. The acrid smell of burning stung his nose, and he realized the beam was on fire. He tried to pull himself together and wriggle free, but the world swam and the peach pie turned sour in his stomach.
"Help!"
he cried. Similar pleas came from around him, but he couldn't see the injured through the cloud.
"Help!"
The fire singed his hair, and with renewed effort he tried to struggle from under the beam, to no avail. A searing pain began to eat into his neck and shoulder as the horrifying realization that he was burning to death overtook him. He screamed again and again, but seemed alone in a bubble of dark smoke and flaming rubble. Then he could make out a figure rising from the inferno. Lucy Gray said his name, then snapped her head around, something out of his view catching her attention. Her feet took a few steps away from him, then she hesitated, apparently torn.
"Lucy Gray!"
he pleaded in a ragged voice.
"Please!"
She gave a last look at whatever had tempted her and ran to his side. The beam shifted off his back, but then slammed down again. It rose a second time, leaving him just enough room to drag himself from beneath it. She helped him to his feet, and with his arms slung across her shoulders, they limped away from the flames until they collapsed somewhere in the middle of the arena. At first, coughing and gagging required all his attention, but he slowly registered the pain in his head, the burns along his neck, back, and shoulders. Somehow, his fingers were knotted in Lucy Gray's scorched skirt as if it were his lifeline. Her cuffed hands, visibly burned, curled nearby. The smoke settled enough that he could see the pattern the bombs had been planted in at intervals around the arena, with the motherload of explosives placed at the entrance. So great was the damage there that he caught a glimpse of the street beyond and two forms fleeing the arena. Was that what had given Lucy Gray pause before she came to his aid? The possibility of escape? Other tributes had surely availed themselves of the opportunity. Yes, he heard the sirens now, the shouts from the street. Medics picked their way over the rubble and ran for the wounded. "It's okay," he told Lucy Gray. "Help is here." Hands reached for him, settled him onto a stretcher. He released her ruffles, thinking there would be another stretcher for her, but as they carried him off, he could see a peacekeeper force her to her stomach and jam the barrel of a gun into her neck, yelling a string of profanities at her.
"Lucy Gray!"
Coriolanus cried out. No one paid any attention to him. The blow to his head made concentration hard, but he was aware of the ambulance ride, banging through the doors to the same waiting area where he'd drunk his fizzy lemon soda just a day before, and then being moved onto a table under a bright light while a team of doctors tried to assess the damage. He wanted to sleep, but they kept pushing their faces into his and demanding answers, their stale lunch breath making him queasy again. into machines, out of machines, needles jabbing him, and finally, blissfully, being allowed to drift off. Periodically throughout the night, someone would wake him and shine lights in his eyes. As long as he could answer a few basic questions, they let him fall back into oblivion. When he finally woke, really woke, on Sunday, the light through the window said afternoon, and the Grand Mam and Tigress were leaning over him with worried looks. He felt a warm reassurance. "I'm not alone," he thought. "I'm not in the arena. I'm safe." "Hi, Choreo," said Tigress. "It's us." "Hello." He attempted a smile. "You missed bomb time." "Turns out it's worse than being there," said Tigress, "knowing you were going through it all alone." "I wasn't alone," he said. The morphling and the concussion made it hard to recall things clearly. "Lucy Gray was there. She saved my life, I think." He couldn't quite get his mind around the idea. Sweet, but unsettling, too. Tigress gave his hand a squeeze. "I'm not surprised. She's obviously a good person. Right from the beginning, she tried to protect you from the other tributes." The Grand Mam needed more convincing. After he'd patched together a timeline of the bombing for her, she came to this conclusion.
"Well, like as not, she decided the peacekeepers would gun her down if she ran. But still, it shows some character. Perhaps, as she claims, she is not really District."
High praise indeed. Or as high as the Grand Mam was likely to muster. As Tigress filled him in on the details he had missed, he realized how on edge this event had made the Capitol. What had happened, at least what the Capitol News claimed had happened, frightened citizens with both its immediate fallout and its ramifications for the future. They didn't know who had set the bombs. Rebels, yes, but from where? They could have been from any of the 12 districts, or a ragtag bunch that had escaped from District 13, or even, fate forbid, some long-dormant cell in the Capitol itself. The timeline for the crime was baffling. Since the arena stood empty, locked, and ignored between Hunger Games, the bombs could have been placed 6 days or 6 months before. Security cameras covered the entrances around the oval, but the crumbling exterior made scaling the structure possible. They didn't even know if the bombs had been triggered remotely or by a false step, but the unexpected losses shook the Capitol to its core. That the two tributes from District 6 had been killed by shrapnel caused little concern, but the same explosion had taken the lives of the Ring Twins. 3 mentors had been hospitalized, Coriolanus and Androcles Anderson and Gaius Breen, who'd been assigned the District 9 tributes. His 2 classmates were in critical condition, Gaius having lost both his legs, and almost everyone else, whether mentor, tribute, or peacekeeper, had needed medical care of some sort. Coriolanus felt bewildered. He genuinely liked Paolo and Didi, how they doted on each other, how upbeat they'd been. Somewhere nearby, Androcles, who aspired to be a reporter at Capitol News like his mother, and Gaius, a Citadel brat with an endless supply of terrible jokes, were barely hanging on to life. "What about Lysistrata? Is she all right?" She'd been behind him. The Grand Mam looked uncomfortable.
"Oh, her. She's fine. She's going around saying that big ugly boy from District 12 protected her by throwing his body over her, but who knows? The Vickers family loves the spotlight."
"Do they?" asked Coriolanus skeptically. He could not recall, not once, ever seeing a Vickers in the spotlight, except for a brief annual news conference in which they gave President Ravenstill a clean bill of health. Lysistrata was a self-contained, efficient person who never drew attention to herself. To even suggest she could be put in the same class as Arachne rubbed him the wrong way.
"She only made one quick statement to a reporter right after the bombing. I expect it was the truth, Grandmam," said Tigress.
Perhaps the people of District 12 are not quite so bad as you paint them. Both Jessup and Lucy Gray have behaved bravely.
Have you seen Lucy Gray?